The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week I started talking about the ordinary quality of mindfulness and the ordinary experience that it meets. So I wanted to summarize that because I want to follow on from what I was talking about last week a little bit. And so first, just to reflect that, you know, mindfulness itself is a quality that's just very human. It's a natural quality. It's not something that that the Buddha created. You know, it's something that we have as human beings. It's a possibility. It's this possibility to wake up and know what's happening in the present moment while it's happening. And that's something that we all just naturally have. But what we often do with that natural capacity is we don't necessarily recognize that it's happening, or we're not so much aware of what's going on in the present moment. Instead, what we do is we use that recognition of what's happening in the present moment to further our ideas, our agendas, what we want to do, what we want to accomplish, to kind of navigate our world. And that's definitely not a problem. You know, it's like this is part of being human, that we use our awareness of what's happening to navigate our world. And yet, the Buddha recognized this quality as being something very powerful, if it is turned to and recognized in a different way, rather than being to further our agendas, to wake up to what's happening in the present moment, to be aware of what's happening in the present moment, there's something that begins to happen, something that begins to transform. Partly what happens as we wake up to what's happening in the present moment is we start to see what's going on, not only in what the world out there, but what's going on in our minds, what's going on in our experience. And last week I really explored the reactivity that we see, you know, the ordinary, you know, the anger and the frustration and the confusion and the wanting things to be some certain way. So, you know, there's all, it's just like really ordinary, right? We live in that world sometimes in our reactivity. And so, what begins to happen and kind of an edge for us as we begin our mindfulness practice is often that we do meet our reactivity when we become mindful. And it's not always pleasant. You know, it's not pleasant. When we recognize anger, when we turn and, oh, this is what anger is like. It's like, wow, that doesn't feel good. And yet that very movement, you know, that very movement to recognize, oh, this is what it feels like to be a human being that's angry. You know, that very movement is the beginning of a transformation. I think I told the story last week that, you know, when I first began practicing mindfulness, anger was really my doorway. You know, I began my mindfulness practice because there was so much anger, and I was not really able to function very well with that anger. I was angry at a particular person, but you know, that I was feeling the anger. You know, I would find myself just frozen in anger. And so I began exploring, a friend sent me a book, and I began exploring mindfulness of the anger itself. And one of the very first things I noticed was, wow, this hurts. And over the next few weeks of doing that practice, I began to recognize actually that there had been something going on in my mind. It was like, well, it wasn't really a surprise that it hurt, that anger hurt, but it wasn't where my attention had been focused when I was angry. My attention had been focused on the person I was angry with and something, you know, some kind of belief that that anger would make that person miserable. And yet in the process of that kind of view or perspective around the anger, I was really missing that there was suffering happening here and now. And that the anger itself is not necessarily something that leads us to well-being. It definitely doesn't lead us to well-being in this very moment. And so this process of beginning to wake up to our ordinary reactivity begins to point out to us that this kind of reactivity doesn't serve us that well. And there's one of the beautiful things about mindfulness is that as we begin to wake up to that, if we have the courage, it takes courage to meet our reactivity. It takes courage to meet this ordinary, messy, yucky stuff of life. At least that's what I discovered. You know, it's not so easy to meet self-hatred. It's not so easy to meet rage or a yearning for a longing for a relationship that there's not a returned feeling. It's hard. It hurts. And so it takes courage to meet it. And this is one of the turnings in our, one of the wisdoms that the Buddha pointed to, that actually this quality, this ordinary quality of mindfulness, when turned to look at our direct experience, begins to transform us. Partly because we recognize in the moment that it is not well-being. And so that it's like, so that example of, in my mind, of the idea that somehow that anger was going to go out there and hurt the other person, you know, that delusion of what the purpose of this anger was, you know, that this idea that that person's going to be miserable when I'm angry. And as I think I mentioned last week, in this particular case, it was pretty obvious that that was a delusion. I mean, sometimes we can get angry with somebody and it does make them miserable, and there's this kind of, you know, inner, well, good, they're miserable too kind of feeling. You know, what I discovered in this particular case, I was in the Peace Corps. I was 7,000 miles from California, and the person I was angry with was like this, you know, 7,000 miles away. They had no idea I was angry, and so it was pretty clear it was a delusion that it was going to make that person miserable. So, when I began to see that that was a delusion, began to see that the kind of view or the attitude that was underneath the reason or the motivation for the anger was not, it wasn't true, it wasn't beneficial, and yet the anger was hurting this being. That very recognition, when the mindfulness turns and opens to our reactivity, begins to give the mind a different education. It drops down, it's like it drops down a layer or two into our experience, and begins to kind of cut through some of our views and our ideas and our beliefs about what the purpose of this reactivity is, to see, ooh, right in this moment, this reactivity is not feeling good. And with that turning, that mindfulness turning towards our reactivity, it starts to, this is one of the beautiful powers of mindfulness, that when we turn with mindfulness, with the courage to open to it, right? It's not with the idea, I mean, this is an important piece. You know, when we turn to our reactivity, it is an opening too. You know, it's this is what it's like to be a human being that feels angry. It's not a rejection of, oh, I shouldn't feel angry. Mindfulness opens to whatever is here, whatever ordinary reactivity is here. And we open to that, and the mindfulness begins to reveal essentially what's helpful and what's not helpful in our hearts, because our hearts recognize the contraction of reactivity. And so as we turn with mindfulness, and this is really the power that Buddha pointed to, as we turn with mindfulness to our experience, it begins to create the conditions for our hearts to start to recognize that these reactive, contracted states are not helpful. And so the heart and the mind begin to orient to letting go of those in a very natural way. It's not even something we have to, like, say, oh yes, I need to get rid of this anger. It's just the mindfulness begins to, like, weaken the mind's pull towards the anger. It weakens our pull towards that reactivity because we recognize, because the mindfulness helps the system, our organism, to recognize this isn't helpful. And so in a very natural, almost organic way, just opening to, again, with courage, with allowing, opening to our reactivity begins to transform it, begins to weaken it. And for myself, I saw this, you know, we can see this pretty quickly, actually. It's quite amazing. We can see the power, at least, of the possibility pretty quickly. Within the first few weeks of that exploration around anger, I began to recognize that, that I was no longer quite so caught, that I was noticing that anger earlier in the process and could let it go more easily, that the mind, when seeing that anger, began to recognize, oh, this isn't helpful. And so it began to weaken in just a few weeks. And yet it took years for that particular anger to fully go away, but it did fully go away. So this transformative power of mindfulness, an ordinary quality of mind. I think the brilliance of the Buddha to point to this really ordinary quality of mind, a quality of mind so ordinary that most of us don't even think about naming it or recognizing it until we hear somebody talking about it, until we hear somebody say, hey, this is helpful. And this is what the Buddha did. He said, yeah, mindfulness, this is helpful. Look at your ordinary reactivity and see what happens. But also what happens with mindfulness is that we open to our, again, our ordinary experience of delight and joy. You know, maybe we're out for a walk one day and we see, we see a beautiful a bird, flying in the sun, and there's just this moment of being there with it, and we feel our hearts like sing with delight. When we're mindful of that too, you know, what happens there is that the heart recognizes, what we're exploring essentially in some ways is like the contraction and the openness of the heart with mindfulness. We feel the contraction of the heart and we know that's not so helpful. And when we open to the way the heart is resonating with joy or delight or generosity or peace or ease or calm, when the heart feels connected, curious, there's a feeling in the heart that mindfulness understands is, yes, this is the way to well-being. And so this one tool, this very ordinary capacity of mind, has both the power to weaken our reactivity and to strengthen love, kindness, connection, generosity, joy, calm, peace. Those qualities of mind where the heart feels it can relax. And so as we practice, I think often when we first start our practice, many of us, not all of us, but many of us are working with a lot of this emotional reactivity. It's human nature to be reactive. And so when we start our practice, we're really working with that level a lot. And it's not like there's something wrong with you, that this is happening. It's human. And so as we explore, as we work with mindfulness with this reactivity, again, with a sense of I have to get rid of this or push this away, but it's more of a sense of allowing. I think of mindfulness as almost massaging our hearts to begin to release the reactivity and to sculpt the beautiful qualities of mind. And so as the practice continues, there are times when we are practicing that we find some of those more reactive states are much less present. And this happens, for some people it can happen. I mean, when I first started meditating, I actually began with looking at my anger in daily life, and then after a few months of that, before I even started sitting meditation, you know, I was looking at the anger in daily life and beginning to explore mindfulness in daily life. And then at some point I recognized, wow, this is really helpful, this mindfulness. And I hadn't wanted to meditate. You know, I thought meditation, I didn't want to go there. And so at some point I thought, wow, this mindfulness is really helpful. You know, maybe the reason they call it practice is because sitting down and meditating helps you cultivate this quality of mindfulness so that it can be used in our daily lives. And so some 3 months or so after I started my mindfulness practice, I began meditating. And initially in my meditation, actually pretty early in my meditation, it was really kind of ordinary. You know, it's like for some reason in that particular time, it was like my mind was going, oh, she's sitting down and closing her eyes. Thank goodness we don't have to deal with all of this junk. You know, so there was that sense of just being, you know, just sitting there with kind of, you know, the body, the sensations, the breathing, the hearing. And so there was a kind of an ordinary experience. And so, you know, early in my meditation, there was a time when the reactivity was not so up. And this happens at different times. What I've discovered in my own practice is that we kind of come and go in our sitting meditation, at least, through periods where, you know, the emotional stuff comes up and we work with it in our sitting practice. And at other times when we're sitting and it's just like, oh, it just seems like, you know, I'm sitting here breathing, or, you know, I'm sitting here feeling my body or hearing the sound. And so, you know, we can move into these times in our practice where things just feel a little bit more calm, more settled, more ordinary. And sometimes in that, you know, that ordinariness, you know, this, sometimes when we start to just sit and it's just like, well, it's just breathing and it's just hearing and just body sensations, and it's like, what's the point? You know, why do this? And so we, you know, there can be a period where there's right there already, there's a little bit of judgment or a little bit of maybe boredom or a little bit of like doubt, perhaps, doubt that this is useful. You know, why bother sitting and just feeling my breath? Why bother sitting and knowing sounds coming in? So why bother? So this right there, you know, that already is a form of, a kind of a subtler form of reactivity in a way, that as we start to recognize, okay, so some of our more obvious kinds of reactivity begin to, you know, take a break, perhaps sometimes in our meditations, and we're just sitting there with, you know, breathing and hearing. And so there's maybe a little subtler form of aversion or a subtler form of wanting that comes up around that. It's like, I've heard that, you know, if you can do this for long enough, you start to feel really good. You know, it starts to so where is that? You know, why am I not feeling that? Or just like, well, I'm just so bored. I mean, breathe in, breathe out, why bored, you know. So that itself is a kind of a subtler form of reactivity that actually is, again, really ordinary. You know, how much of our life do we go through? You know, it's like in our lives we kind of orient to highs and lows sometimes. You know, it's like we want to have those great vacations or those great moments, or, you know, we somehow feel really alive if we're tumbled into this. I know that for me, being in that anger, boy, I sure felt alive. You know, it's like even the negative things sometimes we have a sense of it being more meaningful. I don't know, somehow. Yeah, it's really meaningful to be really angry, or it's really meaningful to feel like life is pointless. I had that stage. I went through that stage too. You know, it's like, yes, exactly. That was the one. Meaningful to feel like life is meaningless. It's like it's really deep. You know, it's really deep. So it's really important. And all those people that find meaning, they're just like, they are just something else. You know, this was the way my mind operated in college. I don't know. So we tend to kind of orient to highs and lows in a way. And, you know, what is it? What happens when we find ourselves in the middle? What I think often happens in our lives, if we're not, you know, really oriented towards curiosity about what's happening, we may actually start to create highs and lows. To get those hits of feeling alive, or to get those hits of you know, meaning, or, you know, whatever it is that we orient to. And so, you know, as we start to enter into a more ordinary realm of, you know, just being with breath and sounds and body sensations and maybe thoughts coming through and moods, we just start to be present for that. What we can start to see is like the beginnings, or the way our mind tends to leap off of something, to create something. So for instance, you know, a simple example, you know, we're sitting here in meditation and in this room, and we're sitting here with our experience, and suddenly a loud motorcycle goes by. So there's that sound. It's kind of ordinary, you know, it's just a motorcycle, it's a sound, and yet sometimes we might have a sense of having been attached to something we were paying attention to in the moment before, and we get angry right there. You know, it's just an ordinary experience of a sound, and, you know, don't they know there's a meditation center here? They should go slowly by this corner. So boom, there's that anger that gets created out of something ordinary. And we can start to watch, we can start to see from very ordinary experience where our reactivity is born. And it's kind of amazing to start to see this and to start to recognize how, at times, one of the kind of interesting contrasts to that is at times we're sitting here and we're just exploring our experience, and the sound of the motorcycle goes by, and it's like, wow, that's amazing. Ooh, the wave of sound that comes through. And it's like, the whole body explodes with vibration. It's like, whoa, that's pretty intense. And, you know, it's like, and you're right there for it. And that the mind doesn't move into reactivity. And actually, it can move into a kind of a delight, because it's just right there for it. And we begin to recognize that the movement to reactivity a large contribution of that move into reactivity comes from our ideas, our agendas, our views, our beliefs, and that it's optional. So we start to see this process of reactivity being born by being willing to sit in the middle of just kind of ordinary body sensations and sounds and breath and thoughts going through. And then at a deeper level, even as we start to recognize, you know, the reactivity, how it gets born. You know, if you see in the moment, if you see, in fact, you know, that there's the sound, and then you see the mind go, oh, you know, oh, what? Right there, if you're present for that, you may feel the contraction of that thought, the contraction of that, oh, don't they know, just the very beginning of that, don't they know there's a meditation center here? Ooh, you feel a contraction there. And if you're mindful for it, the mindfulness begins to orient us to, oh, that's not necessary. Again, in a very natural way, it can begin to release it. And we can see almost sometimes just the beginning movement towards reactivity, and we can see it dissolve. As we see a tightening like that begin to release, there's a kind of a... It's hard to describe, but there's a kind of a... The release of reactivity, if we're present for it, has a very it's a delightful and it's like the heart goes yes to that. The heart says yes. That's what I've been looking for. That kind of letting go. And so it's hard to describe that, but we can begin to feel that. And it creates, that release of reactivity allows other kinds of states to become available, like calm, like joy, like delight, like peace. And then we're kind of bathed in those states. And so, you know, this kind of ordinary, looking at our ordinary experience, basically, it begins to teach us about our minds. Begins to teach us what happens in our minds. Begins to show us how. In a way, I think it's how the heart really wants to live. Not contracted, not held tight, but with a sense of spaciousness. And yet the way through that is to open to the contraction, not to resist it, not to fight it. Again, the ordinariness of that contraction. We open to that. We may feel it release. And that movement begins to, it's like mindfulness gives our mind a good education. A different education than we've gotten about what would actually lead to well-being and happiness in our lives. And then, as we practice, you know, even more of that reactivity can fall away, and we're just sitting in the field of ordinary. For me, this was it was an interesting shift in my practice at some point where I had kind of gone through. Places where, you know, I focused on concentration for a while and was really, you know, if you practice with concentration, so concentration being, you know, staying with experience, maybe staying with one experience, like the breath. And that's a pretty ordinary thing too. It's kind of amazing. You just turn your attention to the breath. Ordinary mindfulness, ordinary breath, you turn your attention to that, and it creates conditions in your mind of concentration, it lets the mind all come together in one place. And something about that feels really good. The system really likes that kind of attention. That's at least what I've found when I did some concentration retreats. It's like, oh yeah, you know, the body and the mind really likes this kind of attention. It almost felt like all my cells were singing, yes, this is nice. It's like they were all pointing in the same direction and all feeling aligned. So again, you know, it can take you to these extraordinary states of bliss, of rapture, of real tranquility, where the mind is just so still. And in those states, the mind kind of goes, yes. And then, you know, paradoxically, it starts to hold on to those. It begins to contract to say, oh, that's what I need. That's what I want. And then we start to feel, oh, some suffering around that. Because we're contracting. We're wanting something in particular. And at some point in my practice, there was I stumbled into this in a way. It was just like walking through a meditation center. It was on a long retreat. I was just walking through a meditation center or doing walking meditation. It's just like, wow, you know, it feels pretty ordinary. It doesn't even feel like I'm meditating. But, you know, I'm aware. It's like, I had to almost check, am I aware? Because it just seemed so ordinary. You know, I'm just walking. I'm like, it's ordinary. It's not like there's any kind of amazing, like, you know, seeing of experience, like with lines drawn around it, or, you know, sometimes when we get into a concentrated state, it's like things like sparkle or something. This was just really ordinary, a very ordinary state of mind, and yet very present. It was so ordinary, I had to check, you know, am I really mindful? At that point, it didn't feel like I was doing much to be mindful. It was really just this kind of ordinary experience, but very present for it. And then I began to tune into the quality of the awareness there. And so it's like, okay, yes, I am aware. You know, there is awareness here, and it's ordinary. It's like, you know, it's not like I'm seeing things all broken into bits, or, you know, it's I'm just, you know, I'm walking through a room and I'm seeing people and I'm seeing chairs and I'm, you know, seeing trees and, you know, it's just completely ordinary way of perceiving the world, of being in the world, and yet very, very present. And so I began turning to that sense of presence right there. And in turning to that, that was quite interesting, because what had seemed so ordinary then seemed quite extraordinary. The clarity, the relaxation of heart. And I think what I tuned into there was just that the heart was not contracted. It felt very ordinary, but it also felt very spacious, very receptive, non-constricted. And so in some ways it felt really extraordinary to just be present with completely ordinary experience. And I went and reported this to my teacher. And he interestingly said, yes, that ordinariness is extraordinary. And at some point, that extraordinary will become ordinary too. You know, he was pointing me really to not get hooked, not have some idea of, oh, that is what I'm going for, that extraordinary ordinariness. And so, you know, really I think of our journey in practice is a journey through the ordinary, a journey through the ordinariness of our lives, of our ordinariness of our reactivity, of the ordinariness of just living. The ordinary quality of mindfulness. as Gil sometimes says, applied to an extraordinary degree, allows us to open to a transformative power that our minds have very naturally. Again, the recognition, it really feels to me like the mindfulness recognizes that, how the heart is, the contraction or the relaxation of hearts. And it uses that as a compass. It uses it as a guide and moves us towards just being here in our lives, living our lives. And yet in that non-contractedness, we tend to live our lives with more skill, with less aversion, greed, confusion, and more wisdom, more kindness, more compassion. So those are some of my thoughts. What are your thoughts or comments on anything, any of this or anything you... Yeah, I'm going to use the mic.
Well, one thing I noted that I've heard lots and lots of talk about the three main vices of Buddhism being greed, anger, and delusion, but this is the first time I remember that I heard them linked, like in saying that you had a delusion about your anger. It's only recently I've heard you mention that the person you were angry at was 7,000 miles away, but you seem to be wondering if it was having some, hoping it was having some effect. I'm usually more prone to anger when the person is 7 feet away, but that's just interesting. Okay.
So I think I'll say something about the linking or the kind of connection of delusion with greed and aversion. Because delusion is really our fundamental confusion, our fundamental mistake. The delusion... delusion of a sense of there's several main delusions that the Buddha points to, and that's that we tend to take what is impermanent to be permanent. We tend to take what is unreliable to be a reliable source of happiness. And we tend to take what is not self to be self. And so this confusion in our minds, you know, it operates at a pretty deep level. And those delusions basically underlie all of our reactivity, including greed and aversion. So greed, for example, is born partly out of the delusion that there is something out there that's reliable that will make me happy permanently, and that we go for that thing. And so the greed itself is the going for, it's the wanting, it's the movement in the direction of something that will make me happy. So our hearts, you know, say, I need that thing to be happy. I need that relationship, I need that job, I need that financial situation, I need whatever. We need something. And so that wanting is that movement towards. But that wanting itself is based on a delusion or a confusion that having that thing will make me happy, will make me reliably happy. And what we see as we explore this is, yeah, it does give us you know, that movement to get something, you know, it's like we do, and when we get the thing, there is a little bit of some kind of happiness that happens. We get the happiness of having it in the first place, you know, it's like, oh, I finally got it. I got that thing that I wanted. And we have the happiness of the, this is something we start to see as we turn towards the experience of the reactivity of the wanting itself. We see that wanting, you know, another good part of the happiness of getting what we want is that the wanting goes away. You know, wanting doesn't feel very good. Wanting inherently feels like something is off or wrong. You know, we're already feeling imbalanced. And so when we get the thing, we not only have a little bit of happiness of the having, we also have the happiness of something unpleasant, that feeling of wanting, of dissatisfaction going away. So there is a kind of happiness to getting something that we want. But the Buddha's instructions there, you know, he doesn't say you shouldn't have that happiness of the wanting, of getting what you want. But he does suggest looking at how long does that happiness last? How long does it actually last? You know, some happinesses do last longer than others. Some people are fortunate enough to find a life partner and they live together all of their lives. Usually one of them dies before the other. And there's a suffering there in that, because that goes away. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't have those relationships, but there's a kind of an idea in the mind that this is this, the delusion of greed is that this will last forever, this happiness will last forever. Even if our conscious minds don't believe that, because our conscious minds really do know, you know, our kind of intellectual minds know that things are impermanent. We know that, you know, when I get something, the happiness of that lasts a certain length of time. But in the moment of that wanting, when we start to explore this with mindfulness, I've seen actually, it's kind of shocking. Even something as simple as wanting chocolate, in the moment of that wanting, and in the moment of that getting, there is this belief in the mind that, oh, yes, this is it. It's kind of shocking how the mind works that way. It's like, yes, it believes in that moment for a split second, this is as good as it gets. And this is what life is about. And this is what I need to do. And so that's the delusion that underlies greed, is the belief that having something will make me happy for forever in that moment, even if our conscious minds know that it's not true. And likewise with the aversion, you know, the getting rid of something. If I get rid of that thing, that's what will make me happy. So the belief underlying our movements towards wanting to have and wanting to get rid of is delusion. And yet again, you know, the Buddha doesn't say, stop doing what you're doing. He just says, start looking at it. He says, yeah, you'll experience happiness when you get what you want. Look at how long that happiness lasts. Is it actually the best kind of happiness there is? And as you start to look with mindfulness in your experience, you also begin to see that there are forms of happiness and ease of heart that are way better than having a moment of getting what you want. And that moment of letting go, that moment of releasing, of clinging, is one of those moments. The moments that the non-contracted heart, the heart that is not clinging or wanting something to be other than they are, that is a deeper kind of happiness. That doesn't rely on what's out there or what we're having or what we're doing or what we're getting, but is a more it's more possible, whatever the conditions of life are. Yeah. There's a button on the side, just below the I think it's just under the white tag. Yeah.
So toward the end of latter part of the talk, suddenly with a kind of a whoosh, a cluster of thoughts came. I wondered whether the vitamins that I had put out onto the counter, whether I'd taken them. I hadn't called somebody last night that I told I would. And that I have something important to do when I get back, some phone calls, and would I have time for that because I have another appointment. And immediately, these all just went like...
Right. Uh-huh.
And a clutching. And I paid attention, and I thought, well, I could spend time checking out my body and doing all that. But I thought, this is reactivity. So overwhelm, a mini form, because I can do it bigger, have done it bigger. And I thought, so, okay. So I don't know about greed, delusion. I mean, what I'm basically saying is that's the way nobody else is involved.
Mm-hmm.
I examined it. I said none of it was, you know, life or death. Yep. Could all be fixed or done or not mattered. And then I had the thought, but if I lay it to rest, sort of, then I'll forget all those things again.
Yep.
That's so I started anew.
Uh-huh.
That's all I want to say
about
it.
Yeah.
It just...
This is a great little example to see. You know, it's like your mind will push, but it's like you're sitting there almost minding your own business, and the mind throws up kind of stuff, you know. And you see how reactivity is born right there. And, you know, you don't have to know it's greed or aversion or delusion. It's just like you feel a constriction. That's a kind of sign. You feel that. And then your understanding was, oh, yeah, you know, that's not so necessary. Just hearing, being in this space, the mind recognized, oh, you know, this isn't so, I don't need to hold this. And there was, it sounds like there was a little bit of a releasing of it. But then, you know, the habit of mind is basically, but I'm going to forget it, so I better hold on to it. And, you know, so that brings the pattern back in. But what you can see, too, is like, so in that moment, you know, I find often that the mind will, like, repeat things. You know, it's like, I need to remember this, I need to remember this, I need to remember this. And, you know, there are things that I do need to remember that I see if I don't, like, make a note of them, you know, I might forget it. And so I you know... let yourself write it down or something. That's okay. We can use our tools.
Well, therein lies one problem. Sometimes it's when I'm driving.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I'm right here doing
this.
And
yeah.
So I can take the next step. Or sometimes it's something another person is involved in, and that gets worse. But so the writing down can help, and then I have notes everywhere.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
And then I worry about, I don't know if worries are, I get a clutch about the notes, and I've got so many. When am I going to ever get to that?
Yeah, so that actually sounds like it may be, you know, I have seen that there are certain things I know I need to write notes about, and other things that I know, those are extra. I don't need to write notes about everything. And so that's a beginning to learn. Like the vitamins on the counter, for instance, you know, you'll see those or not. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you don't need to try to remember that.
Right.
So, you know, you can just know and let go about certain things. So that's an exploration to begin to see, is the activity of writing down actually creating more reactivity? Mm-hmm. You know, so to begin to explore that and to... We have to enter into some terrain sometimes of discomfort, of, you know, oh, if I do that, if I stop doing that, or if I, you know, change the way, it's like, I don't know how it's going to be. Am I going to forget everything? Am I going to, you know, so we sometimes have to enter into a terrain of discomfort and see what happens. You know, just explore that field of, okay, I'm going to take a week and not write things down and see what, you know, what happens. Maybe I can begin to learn what I actually need to make notes about, what I don't need to make notes about, or something like that. So, you know, it's there's a lot of moving through discomfort as the practice unfolds.
I remember once at Spirit Rock that we didn't pay attention, we didn't wear a watch or do something, and we just had to get, or some retreat, and get wherever we had to get. And for the most part, it was on time, and occasionally I wasn't. And what I discovered, and also just now from what you're saying, is to be okay with not being perfect, not being doing it right.
Yes.
So these elements of who I am just keep revealing themselves.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And so the discomfort takes the form of going back into deep roots. They won't like me. You know,
yes,
all of
exactly.
That.
It's amazing how deep some of those roots go.
Yes.
You know, about a simple thing like, I don't know, vitamins. You know, this is again how the ordinariness of opening to just really ordinary things begins to untangle much deeper kinds of patterns in our mind.
The biggest problem being that if I'm alone, this process works. I'll leave it there.
and it works also with others. It's harder. You know, it's harder. Yeah.
A possible future topic, how to practice mindfulness and avoid the delusion that it will lead to happiness.
Well, you know, it's funny to say that. I mean, it's like that practicing mindfulness does make us happier, but it may not be the kind of happiness that you're going for.
Right. It just occurs to me that I'm sometimes subject to that view or that greed that this practice will make me happy.
Well, and the exploration there is simply to begin to recognize when you notice that, oh, I want it to do something for me. Already there's a feeling of it's not doing the right thing. Oh, that's what we need to look at right there. Already, that's so. It's time to stop. So, thank you all.